On a Monday, it is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and we're feeling a sense of home in the song called On Wisconsin. In 1961, so the story goes, Bob Dylan drafted some verses about our state. A couple years ago, a Milwaukee musician uncovered those lyrics and made a song, and now it's set to life in a new video featuring dozens of state luminaries.
Cheese and cream, yes, I've known it all my days, and I'm going back to my hometown. I'm leaving right away. I'm headed to Wisconsin.
Which famous Wisconsinites would you want to spotlight? Maybe they made the video. Join in at 800-642-1234. Rob Thomas is features editor at the Capital Times in Madison. He's also social media editor and a film critic. Rob, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So the bones for this song, they're decades old. Take us back to 1961. What was Bob Dylan doing and thinking in Wisconsin?
So he had dropped out of the University of Minnesota. And this is all in his book, Chronicles, where I think a lot of people didn't know this. But he went to Madison for a brief time to try to become a folk musician. And incredibly, he couldn't really crack the scene here. He had met Pete Seeger here, but apparently was not much of a success. So when a couple of guys were driving to New York, he hopped on and
hitched a ride,
basically. They shared driving duties to New York, and the rest is history. He got a recording contract with Columbia, but apparently still had Wisconsin on his mind. And on the day he was going to start recording his first album, he wrote three verses of this On Wisconsin. It's not Tangled Up in Blue by Dylan standards, right? But it's a fun little ditty about Wisconsin, and mentions, you know, one of the jokes is he refers to Wow Wow Toaster, which is Wauwatosa. And so, you know, and he never recorded it, and he wrote it down by hand. And so it had been forgotten for half a century. And then these lyrics went up for auction, and Trapper Shep, who was actually also born in Minnesota in Red Wing, but really grew up in Wisconsin, read about this in Rolling Stone and was like, I can't afford the rights to, or I can't afford to buy these lyrics, but maybe I could finish this song. So he added some more lyrics to kind of finish it up and put a melody to it. And then his manager, you know, knew some people who knew Dylan's people, sent it out to him, and the word got back that it was okay for him to record it. So he, it was on his album that came out in January. Mm-hmm. And so the second part of the story is this video, which has been a year and a half in the making. Dylan fans will know that, there's sort of a famous video called Subterranean Homesick Blues. I think it's one of the first music videos actually where, Dylan is holding these cards with the lyrics.
And these cue cards.
tossing them, right, as it goes. It's still a very cool video. So Trapper Shep had the idea, let's get a lot of famous Wisconsin people to kind of each have a little lyric on a card and then have this little montage of Wisconsin notables.
So, and Shep really had to stay true to the folk heritage. How did he do that?
Well, I mean, and he mentioned this. I mean, this is very much in the folk tradition in a couple of ways. The first is that, folk music is people's music. You take what somebody did before and you add something to it, and then you pass it along to the next generation. So that's really, in his mind, all he was doing. And secondly, folk music is very regional music, right? Whether you're in, you know, 4th Street in New York or in Appalachia or whatever. So the idea of a song about Wisconsin makes a lot of sense to him.
We're talking with the Capital Times features editor Rob Thomas about a song and music video that a modern folk artist wrote from Bob Dylan's work in the 1960s. Have you seen the video for On Wisconsin? What do you like about the new song with inspiration that's decades old? Did you recognize the people holding those cue cards? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Rob, the music video features more than 60 people from Wisconsin with some, you know, pretty solid name recognition. Who are some of those faces?
Well, you've got Senator Tammy Baldwin. You've got Mayor Tom Barrett of Milwaukee. You've got Butch Vig from Garbage. You've got the Cap Times' own Jesse O'Poyan, our opinion editor, is in there with their banjo.
We represent with Michael Feldman.
See, he did a good job sort of getting everybody, right? And then, you know, it's a good mix of like musicians and brewers and politicians. And, you know, that's one of the nice things, I think, is that it's it does feel like a cross section of the state. It's not just like our most famous folks. And it's just very, I don't know, the melody is very sort of cute. He sort of thought of a drifter lying in a railroad car thinking about Wisconsin, and the beat has this kind of swing melody, like you can imagine dancing in a supper club to it in kind of a way. So it's just a very sweet and sort of unpretentious video, which I think kind of reflects the state.
Do we have any indication what Bob Dylan thinks of all this?
Officially, no, but
I mean, do we ever have any indication what Bob Dylan thinks about anything?
You know, the thing is about Dylan is he's actually pretty loose with his stuff. Like did he do a commercial for like Victoria's Secret 20 years ago?
20 years ago.
Yeah, so he's not very precious about his stuff anyway. I don't know if any official word has come back, but like if he didn't like it, you know, he could squash it like a buck. So clearly at some level, he's okay with this.
Are there any cameos in here that were surprising to you or a little obscure?
Let me think. Mark Borchardt, who was in American Movie, is in early. That was really great to see. I was impressed he got Butch Vig, because Butch, I think, really lives in Los Angeles now. So that was really cool. You know, one kind of funny story is that, you know, the video ends with Trapper Shep, and because the last line is, "We might as well stay." The problem is, as a musician, he kept moving so much that they kept reshooting the last scene. And finally, they just shot him in the back of his van, which I think is appropriate for a touring musician, right? Because that really is his home.
Right, right. And so I understand this went viral. This has been seen a lot. Do we know how much it's spread?
I haven't checked the latest like YouTube things. But yeah, it's really had an, especially Wisconsin, I think, but also, you know, it's really a song for people living in the other 49 states who miss Wisconsin. So I think if you're living around the country and you haven't been back in a few years, it does kind of reconnect you with familiar faces of home.
What does this do for Trapper Shep's career?
Well, he's already really on the rise. Like, he's really had a national prominence this year, I think, that I've seen, which is great because he's a great musician. And so I think, you know, he'll forever be known as the guy from Wisconsin, I think. So this only reinforces that.
And I understand this video took years in the making, like, you know, and one connection led to the next.
Yeah. I mean, people, I think Jesse hooked him up with one of the politicians or something like that. But yeah, it took like a year and a half, because you think about it, you have 70 different people and you got to make sure each one has a different part of the song. You don't want to have two people with the same lyric. So apparently it was a lot of editing and re-editing. It was just finished a couple of weeks ago, he said. So it was maybe even more an undertaking than trying to get a hold of Bob Dylan to ask him if you could record a song.
So where did Wawa Toaster come from? I mean, did people really used to say that?
You know, I do not know. I do know that Dylan did go to camp here when he was a kid. So maybe he heard about it and made a joke, or maybe it was a better rhyme with something else. I don't know. But
well, you can find a link to the On Wisconsin video on our website at WPR.org on the morning show page. And Trapper Shep performs in Madison Thursday night, and this song just might make the set list. Rob, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Rob Thomas is features editor at the Capital Times in Madison. Coming up, what will happen to satire now that Mad Magazine is no more? Did you devour Mad as a kid? What was your favorite cover? We're at 800-642-1234. We'll talk life after the iconic Gap-Tooth cover boy. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.
On Wisconsin, calling me that way.
We're talking about what Mad Magazine meant to us. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. After a long and vibrant 67 years, Mad Magazine is ending publication next month. It will still do an end-of-year special made up of some new material, lots of recycled content. So what did that gap-tooth, fictitious cover boy, Alfred E. Newman, teach us about satire? Do you enjoy political satire? What's your favorite show or publication to read? We're at 800-642-1234. Amber Day is an English and Cultural Studies professor at Bryant University. She's author of Satire and Dissent, Interventions in Contemporary Political Debate. Amber, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So how did Mad Magazine shape our humor as we know it today?
Well, I think when Mad Magazine debuted, what was really new about it was its irreverence, right? It was the 1950s and just, that was the subversiveness of it, that it was telling us you don't have to take people so seriously, grown up so seriously, advertisers, politicians. In fact, we can kind of thumb our nose at them, and we can laugh at the hypocrisies.
And it's a Cold War era where not many people are laughing.
Right, exactly. It's a very sort of self-serious moment. And then, of course, as Mad becomes more popular, you get into the descent of Vietnam and Watergate and a lot of disillusionment. And it seems to really scratch that itch, I think, at that moment.
Do you think Mad, as it mostly is shutting down here, does it say anything about what is going on with political satire at the moment?
I don't know if it does. I mean, I think most people, even really ardent fans of Mad Magazine, think that it sort of lived its course, that it, and not that it was doing horrible satire, but it's just that I think audiences have moved on and are looking for it in different forms. So I think it's not that we don't have any satire, that there's a gap now in the absence of Mad Magazine. I mean, Mad spawned so many new forms that, and I think a lot of the people who were working on The Daily Show when it first started, on The Onion, on all of these other sort of flagship forms of satire that we have now, that a lot of them were influenced by Mad Magazine. But then, we're taking it in new directions and we're responding to new realities in their own upbringing and their own environment.
How can you spot satire? How is it different from other forms of humor?
That is a good question. satire, I think, is this sort of tricky combination of play. I mean, there's the humor and wit and play, but it's definitely mixed with the biting edge, trying to actually say something and make some critique. And ideally, I think the best satire is really trying for a corrective, is implying, we deserve better. Like, not just this sucks, but this sucks and we want more, that there is. So it's not just a kind of cynical stone throwing, but there's an implied, like, come on, guys, let's, we can do better than this. And I think, it often gets confused with just straight political humor. And I would draw a line, and others too, I'm not the only one to say this, but I think researchers would say political humor obviously just tackles the world of politics, but it doesn't necessarily, it usually goes after more sort of personalities, right? And appearances and foibles. And so it's certainly going after the people we recognize who are part of sort of our political celebrities, but usually kind of going after them personally, which can be fun. It can be funny as well.
Is that where parody comes in as perhaps a subset of satire?
Yeah. Well, and although parody also doesn't have to go after politics at all, right? Mm. We can have great fun parodying just a sort of a TV show that we all recognize. There is usually a sort of criticalness to parody in that it's saying something about the original. It's kind of poking fun of the original television show or whatever it is. But it's not necessarily, I think the hallmark of satire is that it's actually making a statement about social policy usually, right? Or the things that we take very seriously and that we don't necessarily encourage criticism of. And satire kind of likes to poke at it and say, oh yeah.
We're talking about the end of Mad Magazine with Amber Day. She teaches English and Cultural Studies at Bryant University. So do you think satire can have a political impact, or do you think it's preaching to the choir that it's mostly for entertainment? Did watching a satirical show or reading The Onion ever change your mind about something? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Amber, what has the impact of social media had on contemporary satire as we know it?
Well, it's definitely made it faster paced. And I think there are a lot of satirists who are sort of having to figure out how to manage that pace. Because up until very recently, I mean, even the sort of nightly shows, something like The Daily Show, The Colbert Report, were incredibly fresh, right? I mean, and they still are fresh, but it seemed like they were the quickest, earliest take on whatever was happening, right? They were literally responding to what was happening earlier that day. And now that can actually feel old, which is crazy. But the fact that, you know, if it's something that's really captured people's attention, there's been 1,000 jokes about it on Twitter already by noon. And so I think that everybody's trying to sort of figure out what that means and how to adjust satire accordingly.
And then, so how are we going to see more short form satire? Where will we see that come into the fold?
Well, we're seeing it already sometimes in memes, in political memes. They're not always the most kind of groundbreaking satire, mm-hmm. but they can be funny, you know, and they're playing to something, right? I mean, I think about the memes that sort of stood out. And the one, you know, one of the ones that comes to mind is right after the 2016 election, in the transition leading up to President Trump actually taking office, we had a whole bunch of memes of Biden and Obama looking very chummy together, and then their sort of thought bubbles or their text is underneath it. And the gist of it is just Biden coming up with ridiculous practical jokes to play on the incoming president and Obama having to rein him in. And, you know, sort of, I think in one of them he says, you know, I glued a drawer shut and I put a post-it on it that said secret Muslim agenda. It'll drive him crazy, you know, and Obama's just saying, ah, Joe. And those caught on, I think, not because they were telling us anything super insightful about our, you know, policy or anything like that, but because they sort of emotionally caught on, right? Mm-hmm. I think on the left, there were a lot of people feeling just at sea, right? And really kind of upset, heartbroken, and there was a kind of, it was a sort of in joke, right? A feeling of like, wouldn't that be hilarious? And it also, I think, caught this mythology that had built up around the time about the personalities of those two individuals. And it sort of played into that and was satisfying for those reasons.
Amber, do you see satire as having a more self-selecting audience? Perhaps do you see it more on the left even?
Yes, and yes, both. I mean, it does have a self-selecting audience. I think, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I know a lot of people like to use that sort of dismissively to say, well, what's it actually doing? But it does, it's unlikely that satire is going to convince the hardcore other side. And that's never really been its purpose. And I think a lot of people look at that and say, well, obviously it does nothing then. And I would push against that assumption. And just the very idea, I mean, I heard you earlier use the phrase preaching to the converted. And I like to kind of push back against that phrase a little bit because, of course, it may be preaching to the converted, but there's a lot of utility in preaching to the converted. There's a reason that preachers preach to the converted every week, right? It's because, you know, even if we have a lot of ideas floating around our heads and a lot of commitments and sort of things that we think are true passively, a satirist can still sort of pull one out from the soup and say, this is actually really important and you should care about it right now, right? And mm-hmm. and kind of make us sort of feel the primacy of that. And it can also really sort of strengthen, particularly if you're sort of in a minority, if it's the sort of larger kind of dominant feeling and you hear somebody pushing against that, it can feel like, oh, wow, it's not just me, right? Like, I'm not the only one seeing this. And that can feel good, right? It can feel like there's a sort of strength in numbers or opposition in numbers, mm-hmm. Both of which are actually helpful, right? If you are trying to sort of rally people and rile people up.
Amber Day stays with us. She teaches English and Cultural Studies at Bryant University. We're remembering Mad Magazine and what it brought us in satire, what it leaves behind. Did you enjoy political satire? What's your favorite show or publication to read? Do you ever watch a political satire to get your news? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue with your remembrances, your favorite Mad covers, and the collection you still keep in your attic. That's after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're remembering Mad Magazine and what happens to deadpan wit now. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In the early 70s, Mad circulation surpassed 2 million readers. It's coming to an end next month after 67 years. Earlier this year, President Trump called Democratic presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg Alfred E. Newman, and the South Bend, Indiana mayor said in an interview with Politico, lost on him, he was likely too young to get the joke.
Donald Trump today, in an interview, compared you to the Mad Magazine mascot, said Alfred E. Newman can never be president. What's your response to him?
So I'll be honest, I had to Google that. I guess it's a generational thing. I didn't get the reference.
Do you appreciate political satire? Did you read Mad growing up? Today, do you watch a satirical show? Did watching something like The Colbert Report change your mind about something? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Amber Day is a professor of English and Cultural Studies at Bryant University, and she stays with us. Amber, you know, we were hearing Pete Buttigieg there. Is this a generational thing? I mean, did Mad at the end really kind of break up with a new generation?
I think to some degree. I mean, I think he was also taking a jab at President Trump's age because he could. But I think that is true to some degree. I mean, it just wasn't. It wasn't seen still as subversive and it wasn't at the forefront of the sort of cultural imagination when even my generation was coming into being. I didn't discover it until later, until I really sort of got into satire, you know, but just casually it wasn't circulating in quite the same way.
How do you think the introduction of fake news and this reality of fake news that we live in, how has that changed the potential of satire as an agent of change?
Yeah, that is a tough one. I mean, I think it does make it more difficult. It's harder to cut through the clutter. And, you know, we have this sort of now very imprecise term. Like, what do we even mean when we're talking about fake news, right? Because there was a time when people used that to talk about satire and, you know, shows that are purporting to be, you know, pretending to be a news program. But those shows were never meant to trick you, right? They're not funny at all if you don't get the concept that they're not actually a real news show. And now we have this other, you know, idea of actual fake news that is trying to trick you. And in some ways is the polar opposite of satire. I mean, good satire is actually trying to reveal something, right? To sort of rip down the curtain and say, look at the way the media functions, to take you backstage and, you know, poke holes in the spectacle, as it were. And fake news is trying to do precisely the opposite. So it definitely muddies the waters. And it makes it hard for things to break through, but also makes it hard for us to kind of immediately have a shared set of facts that we all agree on as the sort of starting place that we can then satirize.
I wonder if it says more about the trajectory of media, of traditional media, perhaps, and kind of, you know, what the Onion pokes fun at.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think what all of these, what the Onion, what, you know, what was really sort of revolutionary about Jon Stewart's show when he first started was taking that step back and really and really showing us, you know, Jon Stewart kind of playing all of the clips of a million different morning shows and everybody repeating the same talking points, right? And he just suturing all of those together and kind of saying, look, right? Like, is this a real, you know, honest political debate we're having? No, it is not, right? Everybody's just repeating these talking points. And in a way doing media criticism, right? Showing his audience sort of the flaws of the way in which that system is running.
You know, the President Trump has been huge change in American politics since the campaign and his election. Have we seen those changes reflected in political satire? Where are you seeing that?
The changes you mean Trump has engendered?
Right. In terms of satire.
Well, I think there has been a bit of sort of scrambling, right, to figure out how to react to Trump. I think there were a lot of people who, when he's first elected, sort of feeling like they have to do Trump jokes. And that's sort of, it actually was less about satire and more on the side of that sort of political humor that we were talking about earlier. But it was just that even comedians that stayed away from talking about politics at all, President Trump, his election was so it took up all the oxygen, right? Whether you were excited about it or heartbroken about it, it was pop culture, right? It was what was happening in that moment right after the election. And so if you were a comedian not talking about it, it was kind of like, what are you thinking about? Really? You're going to do mother-in-law jokes? Like, those don't seem very fresh right now. And so everybody sort of felt like they had to weigh in. And now I think it's sort of settling out that different comedians are kind of going back to their corners, as it were. But the satirists, I think, are really sharpening their blades. And we are getting a little bit more sort of into niche satire, the more and more that's more about broadcasting. And as we get more and more sort of niche broadcasting, niche programming, you can do things on television that you couldn't really do in the past, assuming that most of your audience is a friendly audience.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, back in the day, you know, on sort of network television, satire was actually difficult to find. I mean, when Mad Magazine was going on, there wasn't much great satire in television. There were a few examples, and the Smothers Brothers were sort of pushing the boundaries, but they got canceled, right? Like, there were a lot of those shows ended up getting canceled because they were just too risky for advertisers. Advertisers didn't want to offend even a quarter of their potential market. Once television sort of splinters into all of these different audiences with cable, and then, you know, further and further and further, programmers, advertisers are more likely to take a risk because there is more of that self-selecting audience that is, you're unlikely to come across the material if it's completely offensive to you.
We're talking about political satire as Mad Magazine ends its run after 67 years. Amber Day is our guide. She is a professor of English and Cultural Studies at Bryant University. Do you ever watch political satire shows to get the news? What do you consume? What do you remember about Mad Magazine? Do you still have copies? Join in at 800-642-1234. There's a line for you. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Amber, how can satire change or adjust or actually even form public opinion?
Well, I mean, I think one thing that satire can do, or an effect that it has, is it can draw attention to an issue that was sort of on the margins, that wasn't super well known in the mainstream. So there's been a few examples of that, for instance, John Stewart sort of throwing his weight behind the 9/11 first responders and the lack of healthcare support, and repeatedly coming back to that issue and usually generating a lot of upset in his audience. Somebody like Samantha Bee, for instance, did a segment that generated a lot of buzz when she drew attention to the fact that there were all of these rape test kits sitting in police storage rooms across the country, just thousands and thousands of them that had been used on a victim, but had never been tested, right? They were just kind of gathering dust. And she did a whole story on it that did actually generate a lot of new attention, because it wasn't the kind of thing that your average person knew about.
Here in Wisconsin as well, it got a lot of traction. Yeah.
Right.
And so really almost elevating what would be in a news package to advance a story, to break a story.
Exactly. And license journalistic attention. Because, you know, so for instance, when Stephen Colbert started his super PAC and was trying to draw attention to campaign finance laws and how kind of crazy they are, it's one thing for a journalist to write an article about campaign finance, but you know, most editors are going to say, okay, one and done, like, we're bored. You know, nobody's really interested in this topic. I can't make it through, you know, three paragraphs of this without snoozing. Mm. But somehow, you know, when he very savvily made it entertaining, right, and made it enjoyable to kind of follow his trajectory as he created his own super PAC. And that sort of licensed a lot more kind of deep dives into the issue, because they could be sandwiched in a story on Stephen Colbert and how goofy and crazy he's being.
Let's get in Brian in Superior. Brian, hi.
Hi. I've been reading and collecting comic books for about over 50 years, and you guys haven't touched on the early beginnings of MAD and the small company EC Comics that started MAD. And they did horror comics that everyone knows about, the Tales from the Crypt and stuff. Well, it came from this small company, and halfway through in the early 50s, they started MAD, but then a big uproar started across the country that these horror and science fiction things were ruining the teenagers of America. So the Senate or the U.S. government did hearings.
I'm sorry, Brian, you're breaking up. We're going to just quick go to a break here, talking about the early times of MAD magazine. Amber Day is our guide. She teaches English and cultural studies at Bryant University. Do you think satire can have a political impact? Did you watch a satirical show or read The Onion? Did it ever change your mind about something? We're at 800-642-1234. Back in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. It was founded as a comic book in 1952, and it quickly became a cultural touchstone. We're talking about what happens to satire now as Mad Magazine will be pulled from newsstands next month. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. DC Comics, the magazine's publisher, has said that it will still be available by subscription and at comic book stores. So what do you remember most about MAD? Do you remember when The Onion started up in Madison? 800-642-1234. And Amber Day stays with us. She teaches English and cultural studies at Bryant University. Amber, what about those early days of MAD magazine and the role of DC Comics?
I know your caller was referencing the fact that there was some moral panic around the form. And I think that's pretty common, actually, when you have a sort of new cultural phenomenon. And there's usually, especially when young people are attracted to it, there's usually a sort of ensuing backlash that's a sort of wringing of hands and, oh, my God, kids these days, and nobody's going to have a moral compass anymore. But in fact, well, and I'm clearly biased as someone who enjoys satire and works on satire, but I think good satire often actually creates engaged citizens, right? And gets people to sort of care about the world of politics and the world of public affairs. So I don't think it actually ruined any minds.
Let's bring in Bob in Wauwatosa. Bob, hi, what's your story?
Good morning. Well, it almost ruined my mind back in 1962 when I was in kindergarten, because I used a term from Mad Magazine that my father and his acquaintances, who were all ex-OSS officers, used. And that was ratfink, which was quite common in Mad Magazine. And I got suspended from kindergarten for 3 days. And the worst thing was, I didn't even know what a swear was. And I was accused of swearing. And, of course, they wouldn't let me repeat it. But I will say this, all of my father's friends, again, a lot of them stayed in the military or FBI or ended up in the CIA. They all loved Mad Magazine, and they all loved, I think, that the spy versus spy characterization, because I think they had seen a lot. They were all upwardly mobile, first or second generation immigrants, and they did not see authority as something that should be respected without some sort of trust.
Bob, thank you so much for the call. And really quickly here, let's bring in John in Brown Deer with thoughts on this. John, hi.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd just like to point out that political satire is rather old. In the era prior to the French Revolution, the encyclopedias, which included Denis Diderot and Voltaire and many others, wrote some very trenchant satire directed at the ancient regime and the royalty of France. And that those men were actually hunted down and their lives were in danger by the royal police or whatever type of force there was at that time. And I just wanted to point that out. That was a very important era prior to the French Revolution.
John, thanks so much. Amber Day, your final thoughts as we wrap up this conversation on satire.
I think your caller is absolutely right. And of course, we could go back further than the French Revolution. I mean, the ancient Greeks were doing satire a long, long time ago as well. So it's not a new art form, although I think it does kind of rise and fall in prominence. And I think we are in sort of a satiric renaissance at the moment of just a lot of satire to choose from.
Where will this renaissance go from here? Any thoughts on how it will change in the future?
I don't know. I mean, I think the one worry I do have is, coming back to this idea of fake news, if we do stop having a sort of central kind of suite of just basic facts that everybody can agree on, then satire is a little bit in trouble, because it's much harder for it to seep back into the public sphere. It's much easier for populations to say, well, I don't believe any of that anyway. So you're satirizing something, but only a certain amount of people actually believe that the thing you're satirizing is true. And that, I mean, not to leave on a depressing note, but I think that's the dangerous territory, right? And I don't know what comes after that.
Amber, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Amber Day is author of Satire and Dissent, Interventions in Contemporary Political Debate. Demand for hazelnuts is increasing around the world, due in part to brands like Nutella and its sweet chocolate spread. Production is on the rise here in the U.S., but it pales next to Turkey, which grows around 70% of the world's supply. As Danielle Kading reports, researchers in the upper Midwest say hazelnuts have the potential to become a new crop for farmers in the region. This is the sound of a machine used to process hazelnuts that Ariadna Chediek calls the cracker.
And when I turn the drill, the nut is cracked in here.
Chediek is an agricultural research assistant with the University of Wisconsin Extension. Those cracked hazelnuts fall onto a vibrating metal tray. From there, the kernels drop into a large container while pieces of the shell are sucked away. The nuts are being processed at the Northland College Food Center in Ashland for the American Hazelnut Company in southern Wisconsin. Chediak says the work is part of a larger effort to create a sustainable hazelnut industry from the American hazelnut, which grows wild in northern Wisconsin.
Well, this is a good area because there are native ones in here, and people used to harvest and collect. And
Todd Rothy, who manages the Northland College Food Center, says hazelnuts are just one crop that could be grown locally to benefit the region.
If we can identify at least one hazelnut product that could be processed, packaged, and distributed from our area, that's going to create jobs, keep dollars circulating locally, help build, you know, our local economy here.
The Universities of Wisconsin and Minnesota formed the Upper Midwest Hazelnut Development Initiative more than a decade ago to identify the best hazelnut seedlings for commercial production. They're now cloning those seedlings, which will start going out to growers next spring. UW Extension Agriculture Agent Jason Fishbach co-leads the initiative. He says hazelnuts could be a way to tap into the $34 billion global nut market.
And Wisconsin doesn't participate in that at all.
He says the American hazelnut could follow in the footsteps of another Wisconsin native, cranberries. The state grows more than 60% of the nation's cranberry supply. But he says hazelnuts take time to grow, with no harvest expected until 4 years after planting. Fishbach says the upfront costs are similar to fruit crops like apples and blueberries.
But then once it's established and growing, you've got a low input. Basically just do some weed control and harvesting, and you've got big income for years and years and years.
Agronomy professor Don Wise with the University of Minnesota says farmers can still earn money off the land while hazelnut trees mature.
They can be grown in an alley cropping system where you can farm between the rows.
He says hazelnuts have potential to become a major oil and protein crop for the upper Midwest, and the mature trees also offer environmental benefits.
And gives complete soil cover, excellent nutrient management, no erosion.
Other researchers, like horticulture professor Jed Cahoon with UW-Madison, says they're exploring a variety of native plants, fruits, and crops grown in other parts of the world that could hold potential for Wisconsin farmers.
Unfortunately, we find ourselves not only in the corn, soy, dairy world, but even in the specialty fruit and vegetable crops in an oversupply situation in many cases. So what we're really trying to do is figure out what our climate, soils, and unique production characteristics can do to give us a niche in agriculture that can't be replicated as easily elsewhere.
Fishbach thinks hazelnuts will be part of the mix. He says production costs in Wisconsin are lower than Oregon, which produces the vast majority of hazelnuts in the U.S. Plus, he thinks the flavor of native hazelnuts may favor the region.
So when people eat a fresh harvested, fresh roasted hazelnut, their eyes just explode. They're so excited. They just taste amazing.
If people follow their taste buds, Fishbach is confident the market will follow too. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio. And this is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.